all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
Welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone. I'm the officer of the deck today. We've got some great programs for you. I think you'll find very interesting. We always want to remind you, you can find more about Veterans Radio at its Facebook site or by going to veteransradio.net, where we're on the web 24/7. You can find a lot of our podcasts there as well. We post new ones every Tuesday, so you can get a new story, a new interview, something you didn't know before by going to veteransradio.net. And before we get started, we want to thank our sponsors. First up, we want to thank National Veteran Business Development Council, NVBDC.org. It was established to certify both service-disabled and veteran-owned businesses. You'll find out how they can help your business by going to NVBDC.org. We want to thank Legal Help for Veterans. Legal Help for Veterans fights for veterans' disability rights all across the nation. You can reach them at 800-693-4800 or on the web at legalhelpforveterans.com. We've got a couple of great stories to tell you today. I think you're going to find these interesting. One is informative, that a lot of veterans got exposed to PFAS compounds. These are compounds that are really ubiquitous. You now hear the general press refer to them as the forever chemicals. But they've been in use in the military for a long time, and maybe you used them or you were around them with firefighting foam on the Navy ships and Coast Guard ships, or maybe you were exposed to them while on the flight line. The Navy still uses a firefighting foam with PFAS in it and says it can't find a decent replacement. But very interesting story. And then we're going to get a little more, oh, maybe lighthearted, historical, interesting, and talk to a commercial photographer who has photographed and told the stories of World War II bomber jackets. You know, those cool leather jackets with art painted on them, a lot of them out of the European theater. Very, very interesting stuff. A great little story. I think you'll find it interesting. So sit back and enjoy. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio Representative Alyssa Slotkin. She's a congresswoman from Michigan's 8th Congressional District. Representative, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we're really excited to have you on to talk about an issue that is coming up in the future, if you will, but we're gonna connect some dots. We're gonna talk about PFAS contamination, but we're gonna connect some dots because military service does expose folks to a lot of toxic materials, and Congress has been kind of moving the ball along as it did in Camp Lejeune water exposure, and now PACT Act and burn pit exposure, and we're gonna talk about that. Maybe PFAS exposures going to be the next thing that has to be addressed. But first, I guess I'd like you to talk a little bit about your, well, let me set this up so you don't have to do it yourself. Your investment in these issues is real, and that's because you served with the CIA in overseas in Iraq. You're married to a retired Army colonel who served 30 years as an Apache helicopter pilot. You have a stepdaughter who's an Army officer and one who's a physician. And I understand that you and your husband met in Baghdad during the Iraq War. So this isn't just a political issue for you. Your family's invested in this issue, isn't it?
Yeah, we're a military family. And I think the issue of toxic exposure, you know, if you've served abroad in a war zone, certainly you know that you were exposed to lots of things. You felt it, you smelt it, you experienced it. And I think, you know, frankly, between that and then being a Michigander, where we've had such problems with our water, particularly, you know, lead in our water, it just led me to just really focus on these issues when I became a member of Congress in 2019.
And you represent an 8th Congressional District, which is Ingham County, Livingston County and northern portion of Oakland County. None of those locations really have military bases, but this is a bigger issue, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, they don't have military bases, but we have, first of all, a ton of veterans who live in our community and who were exposed to various things in various portions of their career. We also have commercial PFAS problems. We have contaminated water, contaminated soil in a number of sites throughout the district. And, you know, the one thing about Michigan is water is part of our identity, right? And I think we are looking harder than most states for those chemicals in our water, in our ground soil, and we're finding them. And so it's just an issue that is kind of never far from the you know, front page on our in our office, because it whether it's commercial or military, it's just real here.
Yeah, and for those who are thinking, well, I you know, skipped chemistry class in high school, what the heck is PFAS? This is not a chemistry test. We're not trying to train anybody up here on all the different types of PFAS or PFOA compounds that exist, but they're man-made chemicals that had a particular use for a number of applications that at the time everybody thought was wonderful, such as firefighting foam, and many of us in the military either trained or used firefighting foam to extinguish petroleum-based fires, whether they be on the flight line or on ships. But we also, this PFAS, PFOA compounds are the water-repellent compounds that were put into fabrics and all kinds of different things. So there was a point, I think the DOD began using this firefighting foam in the 1970s. So this is a 30, 50-year-old problem that we're now beginning to focus on. So no more chemistry on PFAS and PFOA. But Representative, you were in support of the bills dealing with Camp Lejeune Water, with the PACT Act. And those bills kind of nudge or authorize the VA to deal with certain health care issues and compensation issues. Talk to us about Congress's role here in trying to make sure that veterans who got exposed to things are taken care of.
Yeah, well, my closest involvement was on the PACT Act, where myself and Representative Peter Meyer from the Grand Rapids area co-sponsored the bipartisan burn pit legislation, right? These burn pits that every veteran who served in a war zone, certainly from the Persian Gulf War on, were exposed to. We burn all of our trash, as everyone knows. We burn everything, plastic. We often use jet fuel to start the burn pit. I mean, just a lot of, you know, bad stuff in the air. We co-sponsored that legislation, which eventually was taken up by the PACT Act and passed. And I think the thing that we all had in mind as we were putting forward this legislation is what the Vietnam generation went through, the Agent Orange generation, right? The veterans of Vietnam who got exposed to Agent Orange and who for the better part of 30 years had to fight for recognition from the VA that Agent Orange exposure led to the health problems they were struggling with. And we made a concerted effort to say, we're not going to let the Persian Gulf era and the 9/11 era veterans go through that same, you know, laborious process. So we put together our legislation. I'm on the Veterans Affairs Committee along with the Armed Services Committee. So being on the VA committee, you get to push your agenda pretty hard, which we did. And I think the key thing that people need to understand as we, you know, then go on to talk about PFAS is you have to have scientific studies that can connect the exposure, let's say to burn pits or Agent Orange, or now maybe to PFAS, to specific health problems that veterans are experiencing. With burn pits, with certainly with Agent Orange, you could easily do that. It took too long to get those studies done, but the VA wouldn't move and Congress wouldn't move without those studies. With burn pit legislation, you know, I think people had gotten hip to this process and there had been scientific studies that could credibly and reliably link 23 different conditions to burn pit exposure. Everything from late adult onset asthma to sinusitis to kidney problems. And you'll see in our legislation that those 23 conditions are the ones that the VA now has to train for. And it now has to say, look, if you've got one of those conditions, the presumption is if you served in a combat zone that you got it from burn pit exposure. So the lesson there for me was you need scientific studies, preferably funded by the federal government, to move it along. And that's basically the process we've been trying to follow on PFAS, you know, making sure the science is there to understand people who handled that firefighting foam, what did that exposure end up resulting in a scientific provable way.
And I think that's what gets lost maybe in the general public is all that extra work on the research and medical side before Congress can authorize VA to move in a certain direction. It takes time and scientific study, and there's a lot of frustration, but you're right. You know, you learn the lessons from Agent Orange and say, okay, well, we've got to prompt this along a little bit, and you helped prompt this along by getting some funding in the National Defense Authorization Act a couple of years ago. Tell us how that, again, kind of advances the ball.
Yeah, so, you know, folks may not know that the way that the U.S. military is funded is through the National Defense Authorization Act. It's a big bill, you know, that passes every year because it has things like military salaries in it and funding for our weapon systems, our bases, housing, et cetera, et cetera. It's, you know, even in a fractious time in Washington, that NDAA passes every year. So it is it's become a very important vehicle to legislate. And starting, you know, from 2019, when I first got on the committee, I started pushing this issue of PFAS and making sure that there's more accountability, particularly around our military bases. A lot of our military bases, not only do they expose veterans, by the way, but the communities that live around the bases also have very high levels of PFAS oftentimes. And we see that in Michigan in places like Oscoda. So we've passed a bunch of amendments, everything from making sure we're doing PFAS testing at National Guard installations, placing moratoriums on incinerating that firefighting foam, right? Like let's not make things worse, but then also, requiring, first of all, the Pentagon to notify Congress of all releases of PFAS foam, and then doing things to incentivize, as you say, the research. So the idea we had was creating a prize program to incentivize development of these, of like non-PFAS firefighting foams. How do we wean ourselves off of these materials? And then putting money into the NDAA to research not only just alternatives, but just the science of the, you know, illnesses that our veterans were getting from PFAS. So we put all of that in over multiple years. Did a bunch of other things related to PFAS, and we're helping to establish that record of science, and then in the meantime, figuring out a way to wean ourselves off. I mean, there are research institutions that are studying, you know, alternatives to PFAS foam in the form of shaving cream. I mean, you know, what other things can we do? I'm not saying that's going to be the answer. I just think it's hard to go to the military, same thing with our firefighters, right, and say you need to wean yourself off this toxic stuff, but by the way, now we don't have an alternative for you.
Yeah, and
so
I think that,
do all of that.
I think I've read that the Navy is still using and is allowed to use for a few more years PFAS on ships, the firefighting foams, because they say it's the best thing. And if anybody who's been on ship, as I have, your biggest fear is a fire on the ship because there's no place to go. And
exactly.
And so the Navy's concerned about that. So there's got to be research to say, well, what's going to replace it?
Exactly. And we wrote that legislation that gave the Navy special dispensation because of those, you know, the exact circumstance you're talking about. You have to live in the world of reality when you're doing this, right? You can't just say, you know, I'm in Washington and we need to cut off all foam without it, you know, surviving the actual use that you need it for. So, you know, I'm trying to manage both sort of understanding very well from being at the Pentagon, being an assistant secretary of defense, knowing the needs of the military, with also now being a representative that represents a lot of people, a lot of veterans who are complaining about health risks due to PFAS exposure.
Yeah, and I think we're talking to Congresswoman Elisa Slatkin from the Michigan 8th Congressional District, who's been instrumental in advancing some of these toxic exposure issues, and we're focusing today primarily on the PFAS contamination and trying to understand the background work that's going on, which may ultimately lead somewhere as it relates to some legislation for health care services and disability services from the VA. But this is not a particularly, allow me to use the word, sexy issue. Burn pits overseas fighting terrorists. Cool, you can get Jon Stewart and Hollywood people involved. But PFAS is really an exposure here at military bases in the United States during normal operations. Do you feel that it just may not ever get the momentum because it doesn't have that kind of appeal?
You know, I don't feel that way. And I guess part of it is because we're about to have a bit of an earthquake on the issue of PFAS coming to us certainly in the next year. And that's because the EPA is right now, as we speak, reviewing their own scientific standards for what's safe in, you know, what PFAS levels are safe and not safe for people in drinking water and in soil. And I think for those of us who've been focused on this issue, we have been arguing for a long time through multiple administrations that the standard the EPA was using, 70 parts per billion, was just not really based on science. That actually, that's too much exposure, that will make you sick, and you need a lower number to be safe. Michigan went ahead, because as I said, we're real leaders on this issue because of our drinking water concerns. And we went ahead and changed the Michigan standard to 7 parts per billion. Real different, right? And the EPA has signaled that they, in the next year, are going to change the PFAS standards for safety based on science. This is a big deal. And I said, you know, to the military directly, to the Pentagon, you guys have a bit of an earthquake coming when the EPA changes that standard. Both, you know, what you're allowed to seep into the ground at bases, but also the exposure for the active duty and National Guard, you're going to have to change up what you do here. And it's coming. It's a coming. And I think that as that standard changes, it's going to put a lot more focus from the surrounding communities, from our veterans on this issue. Now, always helps to have a Hollywood star, and I'm going to nominate, without his permission, Mark Ruffalo, who is the star of a movie on PFAS called Dark Waters. It was a civilian use. 3M was using it for years and making communities in West Virginia very, very sick. But he's someone who's come to Michigan on Flint water issues, lead issues. So I'm hereby nominating him to become the new in-your-face Hollywood star of the PFAS veteran exposure.
I think that's a great suggestion, Congresswoman. I'm going to be promoting that one way or another. Because unfortunately we are in a world of media and attention, and there's so much stuff going on. You kind of have to build up a public support, and sometimes it has to be done this way, right? Because it helps those in Congress say, well, okay, let's, you know, we've got 100 good priorities. Let's move number 99 up to number 3. And that's right. Just reality of the real world. As you said, you have to live in the real world, don't you?
And yeah, the real world includes, you know, at the end of the day, the most difficult issue that we had to surmount getting the PACT Act passed was money.
Absolutely.
Right? It turns out that, you know, if you're going to cover another 3.5 million veterans nationwide who were exposed to burn pits and have, you know, ailments due to their burn pit exposure, that costs a lot of money. And there were a lot of people in Congress who didn't want to spend that money, right? They're more fiscally conservative. They want to spend on something else. There's a million reasons why people didn't want to spend that money. And I think what the public pressure does, especially from veteran groups, by the way, is really say to those people, like, look, if you have the money to send them to war, you have the money to care for them when they come back from war.
Amen.
And,
amen.
You know, so that public exposure helps. And I have to say, the other thing on the burn pits that really matter, just like Agent Orange, is you have advocacy groups that are based, that are made up of veterans and their spouses who are fighting and can tell their personal stories on this issue. That's what we had on the burn pit legislation. And it wasn't just John Stewart. I mean, it was old school, right? They came to Congress, these veterans, and they hunted us down in the hallways. They had their cell phone cameras out. They were trying to get people to sign on to that legislation. And if they would stand at the bottom of the Capitol steps when we would finish a vote, you would see them there, including John Stewart, by the way. But you just, there's nothing more powerful than someone who has served and their spouse showing up and telling their personal story and saying, look, we know you like to smile and take pictures with veterans, put them on your desk, have them in your office. This is a real world issue and we need you to address it. And we're not going to let you, you know, skirt away without supporting it. So that was what made the difference in the end.
Well, and the reason we're talking to the Congresswoman is because she's going to be candid and honest with you and tell you what matters and how to make change. And that's, I think, for the veteran community, sometimes we get frustrated. We say, oh, nothing ever changes. They never listen to us. They just take smiling photos. But you're Congresswoman Slotkin's given you the playbook. If PFAS exposure is important to you, how to get it done. I do want to raise one more question that maybe you can myth bust on. And we all know that money's kind of at the root of a lot of these decisions because you have to be able to pay for it. And there, I've talked to veterans who've said, well, the PACT Act was an incredible act. It's the most important act in, you know, 30 years. But it probably means we'll never get anywhere on PFAS because all the capital, meaning goodwill as well as funds, have been sucked up, and there's no way Congress will go forward with PFAS because they did what they did on the PACT Act. Is that just being too darn cynical?
Yeah. Yes. I think that that is underestimating the power of veterans who become activists on a whole host of issues, but certainly on this issue. And while it took a lot of work, it is true, and we had some real shenanigans at the end with senators voting yes and then switching their vote and voting no. And, you know, you had some shenanigans we had to push through. So it did require a lot of capital. That is fair. But you should see the number of activist groups who come knocking on our doors every single week. No one has more social capital than veterans on both sides of the aisle. So I just don't believe that that's a fair statement to say we're done. You know, we're done for another generation. Truth be told, it took us about 18 months to get the PACT Act passed, from like conceiving of it to getting it through committee, to getting it through the House and Senate, to all the activism and everything. 18 months is, you know, not by Washington standards.
No,
it's not.
It's quick.
Horrible, right? And it was because the Agent Orange generation went through almost 30 years, right? So I just think that that's underestimating the power of veterans organizing, of bipartisan groups of veterans, you know, not making it a political thing where it's one party over the other, appealing to everybody and having advocates who can speak to everyone in Congress. That to me is a secret sauce that veterans have that a lot of other groups do not have.
And I think in the PFAS area in particular, it's not just a veteran issue. Burn pits was just a veteran issue. PFAS is affecting all these decommissioned military bases through the BRAC process who are now looking and going, oh, we have contaminated groundwater with PFAS. We've never looked before. Yeah, I think I read somewhere there's 700 bases DOD has identified as having PFAS contamination. It's not just a veteran issue, although veteran issue may be unique in terms of exposure to firefighting foam and more direct health care issues and compensation issues. But as you say, the earthquake is coming when EPA changes these rules. I know the folks up in Wordsmith, Oscoda, have felt that the Air Force was just slow walking these issues. But I suspect that will all change if the EPA makes its changes.
Yeah, that's why it's such an earthquake, right? I mean, the federal government, the military, you know, obviously is a big part of that, will say, we can't make decisions, one-off decisions. We've got all these locations all over the country. When the EPA gives us a different standard, then we'll act and we'll clean up to that standard, right? I mean, they're pretty blunt about it. And so a community advocating, a community doing its best to speak out and speak to the, you know, big Air Force, big Army, anyone, will only have limited success when the EPA isn't doing its job. And so now when the EPA looks like it's going to actually change the standard, that's where you're going to have DOD taking a very different tone with those surrounding communities. That's where, you know, they're going to come in and say, okay, this is the new federal standard. President, you know, Commander in Chief has signed it into law. Now we need to clean up to that level. And I think it's really going to change. And I do think that veterans plus, you know, surrounding communities are really going to have, you know, can be allies in this, as you say, and take that fight to Congress in a comprehensive way. It just takes organization. And I think that is what, you know, I'd love to see more of is folks who, and you know, who's the natural leaders on this are the federal firefighters, right? The folks who work for the federal government and work with PFAS foam every single day. So I spend a lot of time with them because they're kind of the hook. And if you can get them covered, if you can get the government to recognize their conditions, then it starts to fan out from there to veterans who handle this material.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're getting a lot of great insight on this issue and how it works and works through Congress with Congresswoman Alyssa Slotkin of Michigan's 8th Congressional District. You've been extremely candid, and that's why we are so glad that you'd spend a little time with Veterans Radio today talking about not only the PACT Act, which is now a success, but the future, which might be PFAS, and you've given us some hope. I think there were a lot of folks who said this will never happen, but I think you've given us a lot of hope, and it's really important work that you're doing in Congress on this issue.
Well, it's a passion project for me, and it lives in the Venn diagram between my national security experience and my Michigan experience. And if there are groups who want to come see me, come get organized, come talk about it, the door is open to anybody.
Well, that's a great place to bring this to conclusion, because that's an open offer and one people should take up on. Although I am going to start promoting Mark Ruffalo as the face of PFAS. And when they say, who brought whose idea is that? You're getting blamed for it, Congresswoman. We really appreciate the time that you've given to Veterans Radio today to shed some light on this really important issue.
Thanks for what you're doing, and thanks for having me.
So that gives you a little idea of how Congress gets moved to fix problems. I thought it was a very candid discussion about how the PACT Act got moved, but more importantly, gives us some direction as veterans and what needs to be done to make sure that those who are suffering from PFAS exposure, and there's a whole list of health issues associated with PFAS and related compound exposure, how to engage Congress and get them to move to do what's right for our veterans. So, again, information you're not going to find anywhere else but veteransradio.net. That's why we always direct you to our Facebook page, our podcasts, where we're really working at trying to inform you with items that maybe you're not going to hear anywhere else. Let's have a few words from our sponsors who keep us up on the air, and you can always help sponsor Veterans Radio by going to veteransradio.net, hit the Donate Now button, and keep us going into next year. But let's hear from a few sponsors, and then we'll get back to a story that I think you'll find interesting about World War II bomber jackets.
Military veterans touch everyone's life. I'm guessing right now you're thinking of a veteran, a close friend, relative. Maybe it's you. Even the toughest of us sometimes need help, but don't know where to turn for support. You don't need special training to help a veteran in your life. Even small actions can make a world of difference. If you know a veteran in crisis, please call the Veterans Crisis Line, 800-273-8255, 800-273-8255. A message from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-8255. 4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
The story is a little bit about military history, art, individual veteran stories, primarily aviators and bombers. I think you're going to find it unusual and interesting as you listen to this discussion with John Slemp about his passion project of photographing those World War II bomber jackets. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today, John Slemp. John is a 11-year Army veteran, is a professional commercial photographer down in Georgia, but he's got a really cool project, a passion project that everybody, every veteran can relate to. We've all looked at these things and said, those are cool. I wish I either had one or could wear one. He's photographing World War II bomber jackets. John, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you, Jim, very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, I set this up a little bit. I mean, you're not an amateur photographer. You are a commercial photographer, and you do incredible, you know, sort of artsy photos. The rest of us who are so used to just using their iPhone or their camera can hardly appreciate what you can get out of a photograph when you have real equipment and real skilled operators. So I've seen some of your work, John. It's incredible.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. It's been, you know, it's a combination of having the eye for it and the drive to learn the techniques and how to use the gear and that sort of thing and putting it all together.
Oh, and the lighting and pulling out the colors. So this is World War II Bomber Boys is the website that your work shows up on, and you're producing a book. And I know you're an 11-year Army veteran. You were stationed in Germany. But how did you go from that over to commercial photography and then over to this particular project, which has gone on for a number of years? Tell us about this progression.
Sure. When I was stationed in Germany, I bought a camera in January of 1984. I remember it, and the PX. And I went on a tour of Italy with the chaplains from the 3rd Armored Division in April. I took some leave, and we went down there on a bus tour for a week. And when I got back, I walked over to the photo lab on post, which was, you know, part of the morale support activities, and just sought some feedback from the fellow who ran the lab, who was a German, but he was a professional photographer. And he suggested I submit several of them to the U.S. Army Europe Photo Contest, which I did. And we went on gunnery and maneuver training for 45 days. And when I got back, I had this urgent message to call this lady, and so I did, and literally as soon as I got off the train, and she said, can you go to Heidelberg tomorrow night? I'm like, well, what for? And she said, for the award ceremony. And I'm like, what for? And she said, you won first place in the people category, color slides, can you go? And I'm like, sure. And I was off and running. I won a first and a third the next year, and another first the following year, along with a bunch of honorable mentions and stuff. And when I got out, I was a pretty serious hobbyist by then, and one of my friends suggested I try it for a living. And so I went to school here in Atlanta to learn about advertising photographer, and then I assisted established photographers for about 5 years, and then went out on my own, basically right after the Olympics here in town. And I was always interested in aviation. I was a generalist for a number of years, and of course, I decided to start specializing in aviation right when the economy tanked in 2007, 2008, probably the worst time in history to make that decision. but I persevered, and I'm fairly well known in the aviation world now, you know, for my work. And I had always known about these jackets, but I had never seen them. So I put the word out. I belong to the Experimental Aircraft Association. We have a chapter up 18 miles from my house in Lawrenceville. And it turns out it's one of the most active chapters in the country, and a pretty big one too, over 300 members. And one of the members had their uncle's jacket, so he brought it in, and I photographed it, and it was off to the from there. It was gorgeous.
Now, John, what year is this again?
This was in 2014.
Okay, so that's when the idea, the germ of this idea popped through the soil and a little shoot, and now you're off. I mean, now you got to, like, continue this.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I just thought it would be fun and, you know, maybe something to put online and talk about lighting and, you know, maybe an exhibition down the road. Nothing that it's turned into was in the back of my mind at that point. And one of my clients is Women in Aviation International, and I had photographed their board. One of the board members is a curator at the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum. So I sent Dorothy an email with some of those pictures, and 58 minutes later, I literally got a separate email from their curator of the aviation clothing collection, and he said, "We have 15 jackets that'll work for your project. When can you be here?"
I mean, these are just amazing coincidences, right? So somebody, oh, yeah. You know, the divine hand is on you, moving you in a direction, connecting dots from people you know to people who know, you know, who, those people who know, right? You didn't even know the Smithsonian had a bunch of, what'd you call it, aviation?
Of the aviation clothing collection. Yeah, no, definitely. The Big Ranger and Scott have been smiling over me throughout this whole project, trust me. And, you know, so it went from there. And, of course, once I started telling people, well, the Smithsonian let me in the door, all these other museums said, well, you must be somebody. Come on in, you know. So.
Well, you are somebody, and you are a skilled photographer. And you've been in a number of museums. Some of them are private museums, local museums, some of them are national, United States Air Force kind of museums.
Yeah.
But you also have gotten into private collections. Tell us how you, again, sort of be, because that's, you know, that's granddad's jacket in the back room that we've been preserving all these years. How do you get introduced to those?
A lot of it was word of mouth, to be honest with you. And that's one thing I want to emphasize too, you know, besides the, so I photographed 162 jackets, I think, at last count, if, you know, but about 50 of them or so were from privately owned either collections or, you know, family heirlooms. And so a lot of it was word of mouth once it got started.
So as you've gone through this, and I'm sure you've learned more about who made the jackets and how the art got put together, I know you've also interviewed men who had these jackets, but let's start with that. How did these jackets originally come about, and how did they first get turned into works of art?
Well, there was an A1 jacket. The jackets I'm photographing are properly known as A2 summer weight. They're leather, but they're fairly lightweight, actually, and they're not good at high altitude. Anyway, back in the 20s, well, it goes back to World War I. You know, we started and jumped in the war in the middle of 1917, and our Air Force was basically non-existent, so we flew British and French airplanes and a few American planes, that sort of thing. But we didn't have any standardized flight clothing. And so after the war, they started figuring that out. They created the A1, I believe, in 1927. It was standardized, and it had buttons and so on. And then in 1931, I believe, they standardized the A2, and it had zippers, which was a fairly innovative part of a garment at the time. You know, zippers were not widely used at the time. And so it had zippers and, you know, some other innovations. But, you know, so we had them throughout the 30s in the Army Air Corps, but they were manufactured in the hundreds, you know, because it was the height of the Depression. The Army Air Corps was quite far down on the list of items to be funded. But as World War II approached, the contracts started to be letting for 5,000, 10,000, 25,000, and 50,000 jackets. I think the largest contract I've seen is for 50,000 jackets. And most of them were manufactured in the Northeast because that's where the garment industry was largely located. There was a few in Pennsylvania. There was a few around Chicago and that sort of thing. But there were 18 different manufacturers, from what I can tell. And at the time, the military procured all the items that made up the jacket. They procured the leather, the wool for the cuffs and the waistband, the liners, all the snaps and buttons and so on. the zippers, all, and they gave it to the manufacturers and said, build us a jacket. This is the diagram. This is what we want. And it cost about $8 and a quarter to build a jacket. Yeah.
Prices have changed, right?
Prices have definitely changed. And one jacket that was brought to me last summer from California by a friend, I photographed up in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, which is where the big air show is every year, the largest air show in the country. It's called Air Venture. She brought it to me, and I photographed it in a garage in a house we were staying in. And she had it appraised right before she brought it. And the appraiser in California said, yeah, this is worth $8,000.
Holy cow. Yeah, that's, I mean, these, again, are really incredible pieces of history. As you've done this work, have you been able to kind of zoom into when and who decided, I'm going to start putting artwork on my A2 jacket?
Well, you know, veterans have always been kind of innovative in that regard, shall we say. You know, I was an armor officer by trade, and the guys always wanted to put a name on their tank, you know. And we got to that, you know, on the muzzle, the bore evacuator, on the muzzle, you know, on the main gun and that sort of thing. And you know, I'm not really sure who did it first, to be honest with you, but it's a one piece back on the jacket. You know, it doesn't have any seams. And so it was an ideal canvas. And somebody's like, hey, let's paint, you know, our airplane name on there or something like that. And it just took off from there. And not to coin a bad phrase, but, you know, and technically it was against regulations. You know, you're not supposed to defend.
We all did those things against regulations. But it's a little bit of, John, it's a little bit of folk art. It's sometimes, you know, exactly. That kind of stuff's called trench art.
Exactly. Yeah. But, and so it started, and, you know, it turned into its own art form. And the commanders essentially turned a blind eye to it, especially, you know, in World War II, because the attrition rate was so high, you know, especially in the 8th Air Force. When they started bombing in 42, in the summer of 42, you know, it wasn't too bad. The first mission, all 12 planes came back and that sort of thing. And then as it went into late 42 and 43 and the Luftwaffe got involved and the flak became heavy and so on, the 8th Air Force was suffering 60-70% casualty rate.
Yeah, clearly some of this is related to morale, right? To let the guys do what they need to do to have positive morale. Did you find are these the ones that you're able to find today and photograph, are they primarily out of the European theater, or was
I made a conscious decision once the book started to be an idea to break it up by theater. So I've got European theater, you know, primarily 8th Air Force out of England. And then I've got the Italy and North Africa as a separate theater or combined theaters, you know, as far as the artwork goes. And then I've got the China, Burma, India and the Pacific all in one bunch. They were all over the world. But, you know, I'd say probably the most elaborate artwork was done out of England in the 8th Air Force.
Well, we often talk in Veterans Radio about preserving the history and the stories of our American veterans. And John Slump, who's taken these amazing photographs, is preserving that history of really the flight jacket art. John, but you have a kind of a team, and I wanted to talk a little bit about this because you have somebody who's involved with the project who's a fashion and cultural historian. You have somebody who's a design illustrator and artist. Talk a little bit about your team, because it's more than just a great photograph.
Thank you. Yeah, I definitely wanted to do more than just a pretty picture coffee table book, you know. And having seen the other books that have been done on the subject 20, 25 years ago, A, they were not professionally photographed, and B, they didn't really talk much about the guys. They said, here's, you know, Sergeant Snuffy in XYZ bomb unit. But it doesn't say, you know, where he's from, what he did after the war, you know, none of that kind of information. And I just thought it was a missed opportunity, to be honest with you, because once I started, you know, as someone said, well, I forget, it might have been my idea, I can't remember now, but you know, once I started documenting this artwork, these jackets are essentially walking billboards. And, you know, it talks about the guy's service.
The whole point of these jackets were to be individualized. I mean,
oh, absolutely.
It really is his story. Maybe it's the number of kills. Yeah. Maybe it's the number of planes. Maybe it's where he came from. Maybe it's his girlfriend. But that's really a good part of it too, isn't it, John? It's their personal story.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I thought, you know, the artwork was an appropriate way to tell their story. And so that's when I started concentrating on gathering the stories as much as I could. You know, I photographed over 25 veterans, you know, did portraits, 16 wasps and 16 original Rosies, which are not in the book. But, you know, the wasps are mentioned in the book. I've got several Tuskegee Airmen. I photographed six of them because I think they're important to be included in there, too. And, the stories are just incredible. Some of them are well known, you know, like Zimmer and so on, you know, who was awarded the Medal of Honor. But some are virtually unknown. You know, probably most of them are virtually unknown. You know, they're from family recollections and so on, and personal memoirs.
So as you sort of tell these stories, and I've listened to some of the audio stories you have with them, and I look forward to seeing some of the photographs of them. When is the book going to be available so that we can buy it for our dads and our grandpas, and it's going to be a great Christmas kind of gift or a Father's Day gift? What are you shooting for here on publication?
Right. Well, today's the 21st of September, 2022, and I sent the final edit to the designer today. So it'll probably take him a week or so to tweak it, and then it's going to the printer. We're printing it here in the States. I thought that was important, in Houston. And, you know, so it won't be stuck on a boat and that sort of thing. And it's going to cost more, but, you know, at this point, I didn't really care. It's such an American topic that I thought it important that it be printed here in the States.
Oh, absolutely. And, good job on that. I can tell everybody out there who's listening to John, right after we get done with this interview, he's going to go open up some adult beverages, because there's nothing better than sending it off and saying, I'm done with this project.
Yeah, it's been a long time coming to, you know, to more than you know. But, you know, and we're instead of calling it self-publishing, we're calling it privately published. You know, that's a term my designer coined. And going back to the team, so... Yeah, I thought, you know, well, you know, at some point the idea that these jackets influence fashion design worldwide popped into my head, and I'm like, well, why don't we talk to a fashion historian and find out? And lo and behold, I finally found one, a young lady in New York City, Laura McClaws-Helms, who's just a few hours shy of a doctorate in the subject, and she wrote a wonderful chapter for me. It was 22 pages when she sent it to me, and she said, I think I've found enough information to do my own book on the subject.
It really is. I mean, even today, it's a classic design, right? We're seeing a takeoff of that design in the movies. You know, it's a very popular kind of jacket that I think everybody recognizes as soon as they see it, which is kind of an American iconic classic jacket. So, I mean, this is really interesting stuff, I think, for folks. One of the things John mentioned is that he and I bumped into each other because one of the jackets he's doing, Jay Zemmer's, which is in the book, is also there's a story of him on the homeofheroes.com website that we curate. And John asked if he could use some of that story in telling Zemmer's story. And, of course, we said, yeah, but more importantly, I want to hear about the book you're doing. John, as the book gets published sometime in mid-November, how are folks going to be able to find it and order it?
So, I thought about doing bomberboys.com, but I didn't want the FBI showing up, so I decided to put I in front of that. So it's... so it's www.wwii for World War II bomberboys.com. And at some point we'll have it on Amazon. We are already taking pre-orders. We've already had 150 pre-ordered. And it'll be available in bookstores and major, probably aviation museums, to start with. And, you know, so those will be the primary ways to obtain the book.
Do you have a target price on it yet?
Yes, $129.95. And that may sound expensive, but it's actually 12 inches by 12 inches, and it's almost 400 pages.
Well, and, as I say, it's artwork. It's really something.
It is. And, you know, it has an index, too. None of the other books on the subject have an index. I had that professionally done just recently, and I've already used it myself, to be honest with you.
Well, if you got 400 pages, you need a little help finding that story that you want to tell your friend about.
Exactly. And I think it'll be a research tool as well. I actually did a spreadsheet, which will be available on the website at some point, but it's got the manufacturer, you know, the date, the contract number, the number in the contract, the jacket itself, you know, who owned it, et cetera, et cetera. So I've got a spreadsheet on all that. So I've tried to do more than just create a pretty photo book. You know, we've got a section in there on conservation as well, written by a professional conservator. And we were able to, I put the word out through Facebook, does anybody know, you know, an expert on collecting these jackets? And a lot of people said, talk to Jeff Schrader. And I'm like, okay, who's Jeff Schrader? Jeff Schrader is an appraiser for Antiques Roadshow.
Oh.
And he wrote a section for me on collecting the jackets. And it's you know, it's four or five pages, but it's very well done. And he's a great writer, tons of experience. He's got his own company that buys and sells military. And, you know, so, and there's some lovely illustrations in there by a fellow named John Mollison, who lives in North Dakota, I believe. And he is heavily involved with, the Distinguished Flying Cross Society. I believe that's the name of it. But he's been an illustrator for a long time, and he contributed nine illustrations of these aircraft, because I'm sure, you know, there's a lot of kids now that have no idea what a B-17 looks like.
Oh, absolutely. No, this is educational and will cause people to ask questions and be able to tell stories to the younger generation that's so important, which is why we tell these veteran stories.
Right. So, and we've done a few video interviews and several audio interviews as well. So we're going to put that together as well on the website.
Well, we want to encourage people to reach out to John, pre-order the book. We want to encourage them that, hey, if I got a jacket I don't know what to do with. I suspect mm-hmm. John's got a lot of connections in that regards at this point in time. So, John, as we close out here, let's give everybody the website one more time.
Sure. It's www.wwii, for stands for World War II, Bomber Boys, with an S, .com.
Well, we really appreciate you taking some time to talk to Veterans Radio today. It's a great project. It's a great – you're doing great work preserving this history. And it's really something that's only somebody with, you know, the artistic eye that you have as a photographer could really bring this to life. So you're doing a great job on this, John.
Many, many thanks for your kind comments. I really appreciate it.
I'm telling you, they're really cool photographs. Go to the website. Consider whether or not you can buy the book for somebody who's a veteran, really into aviation, maybe has a connection, grandfather who fought over in Europe during World War II. These photographs are just stunning, so I encourage you to at least hit the website for that. As Dale and I have said before, this is our passion project to provide a voice to American veteran stories, but we can't do it without your help, and we've been very fortunate to get the help of sponsors like the National Veteran Business Development Council, NVBDC. Their ongoing support each month is what keeps us on the air. We also have had support from the VA Ann Arbor Healthcare System, which we really do appreciate. the Vietnam Veterans of America, Charles S. Kettle's chapter, the VFW Graf O'Hara post, the American Legion Press Corps post, all in Ann Arbor. So you can help us out by going to veteransradio.com and clicking on the donate button. Maybe it's your family. We've had some really wonderful gifts from family trusts and estates. Maybe it's your post. Maybe they ought to be helping out. But we really do appreciate that support, and it's what lets us continue on. We're going into our 20th year. Think about that, 20 years of this. So it's both a passion project, but one that needs support. So please help us out. Next week, Dale will be back, and we'll tell you a couple of more great stories. But in the meantime, go to veteransradio.net. Check us out there. I'm Jim Fossone. It's been a pleasure to be your host today here on Veterans Radio and bring you stories about PFAS and emerging contaminants and how Congress moves, or about the history of bomber jackets. Really cool stories that you're not going to find anywhere else. So I do think we provide you a unique outlet of information, and hopefully also not only educate you but entertain you. So as we wrap up here on Veterans Radio this week, it's great coming off another great year, and we look forward to our 20th year of being on the air. And until next time on Veterans Radio, you are dismissed.